Can everyone read this? I'm going to be going through a lot of detail and a lot of text. So if you can't read it, would you mind moving up? And if you can, well, you can remain where you are. Okay. Today I'll be talking about Lewis Carroll. He's a mathematician. Well, Charles Lutwidge Dodgson. That was his real name. He wrote under the pseudonym of Lewis Carroll. He was a mathematician. I'm not. So I feel a little bit out of my field in this sense. But I'll see what I can do. Okay. This is the way that Carroll was described in some of his work. He seemed to have derived an almost sensual satisfaction from setting a problem to which he alone knew the correct solution. The desire to perplex never left him. This is just one of the comments made by someone who knew Carroll. Or this is from his biography, but I'm sorry... But this comes out of a lot of comments made. He was continually putting forth complex problems to people, and for the most part, he called it triumphing over them when they didn't get it, and for the most part, they never got it. And later I'll be talking to you about sham answers, where he would, once he didn't get the answer, then he would give you a sham answer, pretending to give you the answer. But within the pretense, the pretended sham answer, was there a clue to the first puzzle? Now, if you didn't get that, another puzzle to solve the first one, he'd send you a second sham answer. If you didn't get that, for the most part, it was done. Okay, a bit of background. Carroll began and continued methodically to study the main works on etymology. Of course, he's forever playing with words and their meanings. That's what he does. His nonsense is all about that. Now, it helps to know that he made a study of it. And when he studied something, he studied it. He's a very controlled man. And this has posed many problems to students of Carroll. In the sense that, on the one hand, we're told that he wrote, in a way, anarchic works, nonsense, without sense. Right? And on the other hand, he's a mathematician. That usually points to a very controlled person, that can a rule follower. On the other hand, you have this anarchic character that writes this nonsense. And this caused a lot of problems for biographers. Part of this, I want to show, I mean, it's not on this lecture, but it'll show that there's no separation here. What he has a particular method that he uses for his nonsense, and it relies pretty much on etymology. What he tends to do is, if he can find one word and find several meanings for that word, then he'll use any one of those meanings. And if you trace a word back far enough, you'll see amazing changes. Sometimes a complete reversal. Okay, so in 1855 he studied etymology. The next year he writes in his diaries that he started studying natural botany. Much more popular in Victorian times than now, in the sense that a lot of people studied botany. There was the language of flowers. When you gave somebody a bouquet, it almost was a full message. He could tell them, like, I hate your guts, you really let me down, and so on, by the arrangement of the flowers. It was actually called the language of flowers. So in some ways it paid to know what each flower meant and the etymology of those names of the flowers. Okay, so I'll get right into a sort of more... Okay. This Miss Hargreaves is Alice, the grown Alice, Alice Little. Okay? Here's what he says. Oh, and please keep these things in mind. T spelled that way, as in going to T. T spelled that way, as in Lottie, which I'll be bringing up, is a girl's name. And T, as in T-I, as in Do, Re, Mi, Fa, Sol, La, Ti. And yeah, keep these things in mind, please. Round, the meaning of round, how it can be used, and walk and go, which sometimes they overlap, sometimes they're different. Okay, so here's what he writes, a grown Alice. I should be so glad if you could quite conveniently to yourself look in for a tea any day. You would probably prefer to bring a companion, but I must leave the choice to you, only remarking that if your husband is here, he would be most very welcome. I crossed out most because it's ambiguous. Most words are, I fear. I met him in her common room not long ago. It was hard to realize that he was the husband of one I can scarcely picture to myself even now. It's more than 7 years old. Okay, notice what's going on here. Okay, he crosses out most. Right away he's using it. Okay? Uncrossed. So that's supposed to stay with you. And look at that. Most words are ambiguous. Okay? So this sits, in some ways, sets them aside. He's aware that most words are ambiguous. So once you're in that realm, how do you communicate? Well, in some ways, very creatively. Now, Carol met this girl. Well, first he started writing, corresponding with her through letters. Her name was Lottie Ricks. Yeah. So here, when they first met, okay, he goes to see her where she's staying at. This is how Lottie describes the meeting to her mother. Says, "My dearest mother, yesterday afternoon there were none of your mentions or Robinsons for me. I was content with none less than the great Lewis himself. I was still the abode before I answered your letters. I went down to dinner as usual and was starting for my meat when the servant put into my hand a card. I turned pale and read, Reverend C.L. Dodson, Christchurch, Oxford. I think I was as much horrified as pleased at first. I had an old everyday blue dress on and filthy apron. But I tore off that and made myself as respectable as possible, and walked with as much calmness as remained to me to Sister Louisa's room, where he was. The first thing he did after shaking hands with me and asking if I was Miss Ricks was to turn me round and look at my back. I wondered what on earth he was doing, but he said that he had been made to expect a tremendous lot of hair, and that he hadn't the least idea what I was like, except that he had a vague vision of hair." Okay, fairly strange event. The first thing he does is ask her to turn around, and he asks where her hair is. Okay. Now, the reason for that is, look at what she says that he expects to see. A tremendous lot of hair. Lot. Okay. You're left with T-Rex. Now, another one. It's just the letter T. Once you take this and you turn it into T, and you have Rick, this is a Greek root for hair. He knows that she doesn't. Okay? So he's triumphing over her. She never caught on to what had happened. And up to now, nobody has. Okay. So now, I'm sorry that this, my computer, actually I have the real one. Here you'll see it. If you go to the little Greek English lexicon, that's the Greek tricks. Trichias, trico, trico, one that is hairy. Notice, little and Scott, everything is related for him. This is Alice's father. Okay, so now I'm going to jump a little bit more into the mathematics part of it, even though I'm kind of avoiding the issue in the sense that I'm not going to be dealing with numbers so much as infinity is a number. Okay, here's how Carol deals with infinities in Wonderland. So this is Alice first meeting the cat. Please keep an eye on, remember the botany? Keep an eye on this tree and this plant. So, Alice meets the Cheshire cat. Here's how she begins with the cat. Cheshire Puss, she began rather timidly, and as she did not at all know whether it would like the name, however, it only grinned a little wider. "Come, it's pleased so far," thought Alice, and she went on, "Would you tell me, please, which way I ought to go from here?" That depends a good deal on where you want to get to, said the cat. I don't much care where, said Alice. Then it doesn't matter which way you go, said the cat. So long as I get somewhere, Alice added as an explanation. Oh, you're sure to do that, said the cat, if only you walk long enough. Alice felt that this could not be denied, so she tried another question. What sort of people live about here? In that direction, the cat said, waving its right paw around, lives a hatter, and in that direction, waving the other paw, lives a March hare. Visit either you like, they're both mad. And then, after a while, the cat vanished. Okay, this is one heck of a way to point to a direction. Waving its right paw around. What's going on there? Now, I figure it's this way, maybe? Could be this way, they're all mad there. But most likely in that direction and in that direction. That's how I'm going to read it. So then, there's the cat vanishing, and this is what happens after. Alice waited a little, half expecting to see it again, but it did not appear, and after a minute or two, she walked on in the direction in which the March Hare was said to live. I've seen hatters before, she said to herself. The March Hare will be much the more interesting, and perhaps, as this is May, it won't be raving mad, at least not so mad as it was in March. As she said this, she looked up, and there was the cat again, sitting on the branch of a tree. Okay, so she walked on in the direction in which the March Hare, right? And she comes across the cat. She walked on, yet the cat's on the same tree. Same exact position as it was before. How can that be? Okay, but remember, she'd been told to walk in that direction. And remember, the cat said, if you walk in that direction for long enough, you're bound to get somewhere. He's dead wrong, that cat. Oh, look, there's a cat. Okay? She can walk forever in that direction. She'll never get anywhere. So in that sense, there's the logician. Carol was a logician and mathematician. Carol, in some ways, playing with his readers, but also playing with these concepts of infinity. What does it mean? And just previous to this, Alice had commented on the Earth rotating around its axis. And then, of course, then the Duchess cuts it off saying, oh, talking about axis, chop off her head. Different axis, but... Now... When Alice gets to the mad tea party... There she is. And now I'm going to make a case that this is the same tree. Because this is the original picture that later was changed. There's the cat on exactly the same tree again, because Alice has been walking around in circles. Now, notice there again that plant and the tree. Now, one of the meanings of that plant, let's see if I can, so later on, to save, I'm not sure, maybe, this is Tenniel's original drawing. Later, they just cut across there, you can see that, I just put Alice beneath it and used that picture earlier. Now, this is Alice and the baby pig. Notice this plant. And this leaf in particular. This is an arum leaf. That's indisputable. If you know anything about botany, that's an arum leaf. This is foxgloves. Carol tells us these are foxgloves. So this is a visual pun. You have an... Pat the gardener puns on this. When he says, what's that in the window? When Alice sticks her arm out and... the rabbit wants to get in the house, and he calls his gardener Pat, and he says, what's that in the window? And Pat says, it's an arum. And Carol puts it in brackets. He pronounced it arum. Okay, A-R-R-U-M. That's the plant. Okay. So here we have an arum. and a glove. Okay? Visual pun. And this is going back in Wonderland. This is going back in time in a way. So in some ways, Alice has been walking around in circles for a while, I believe. And this is earlier yet, where she meets the caterpillar. There's your foxglove. Notice this. This is, we're told this is a caterpillar. The etymology of caterpillar is chat pelouse, hairy cat. We have a hairy cat on vegetation in a similar way as later the Cheshire cat will be sitting on the tree. So as she's turning, things are changing all the time. From caterpillar it goes to cat. So I guess in some ways Alice is supposed to be at the center of the earth at this point, right? Where the whole earth is going round, in some ways her. And so this reflects too. And when, in some ways, this just came to me this morning, in some ways she's going around this tree because it changes position. You don't always get the same angle on the tree. So in some ways Alice is also in a planetary motion almost, going around her own axis and going around the tree. Anyway, Carol's up to a lot of stuff here. So now let's get to the tea party. Because now we'll be dealing with time, the whole idea of if you walk long enough, you're bound to get somewhere. Okay. And this, ultimately too, I'm going to a solution to the Raven and Writing Desk riddle, which is probably Carol's most well-known, famous riddle. I've been pursuing this answer for about 15 years now. And I think I'm getting somewhere now. So this is the way that the Hatter first talks about time and about his situation. He's telling the story to Alice. He said, "Well, I'd hardly finished the first verse of a song," said the Hatter, "when the Queen bawled out, 'He's murdering the time off of his head.'" So now he's fallen, because he's murdered time, it's always 6 o'clock there, right? Tea time. And they go around this table, it's always 6 o'clock. They go around this table, and it's always tea time. And they keep on moving, right? Now when Alice says, "And what happens when you get to the beginning again?" Then they cut off the conversation. Carol doesn't want to, in some ways, deal with that topic. When you get to the dirty place again, will they be renewed? We don't know. But the main idea is that circularity, and in some ways, if it's always 6 o'clock, then you're stuck in time, and yet you're still moving in a circular fashion. Okay. Here's what transpires after. "Have some wine," the marchioness said in an encouraging tone. Alice looked all round the table, but there was nothing on it but tea. "I don't see any wine," she remarked. "There isn't any," said the March Hare. "Then it wasn't very civil of you to offer it," said Alice angrily. "It wasn't very civil of you to sit down without being invited," said the March Hare. "I didn't know it was your table," said Alice. "It's late for a great many more than three." "Your hair wants cutting," said the Hatter. He'd been looking at Alice for some time with great curiosity. And this was his first speech. "You should learn not to make personal remarks," Alice said with some severity. "It's very rude." The Hatter opened his eyes very wide on hearing this. But all he said was, "Why is a raven like a writing desk?" Okay. Your hair wants cutting. Okay. Carol's a logician. This, in Victorian times, it's the same as our now, splitting hairs. If you look at the OED, you'll find that there. So this, the conversation that follows is going to be all about hair splitting. Logically getting at the meanings of words and then splitting those off. And okay. Later on, at the trial, here's the Hatter again. "I'm a poor man." Oh, he's called as a witness. I'm a poor man, Your Majesty," the Hatter began in a trembling voice, "and I hadn't begun my tea, not above a week or so. And what with the bread and butter getting so thin, and the twinkling of the tea." "The twinkling of what?" said the King. It began with the tea, the hatter replied. Of course twinkling begins with the tea, said the king sharply. Do you take me for a dunce? Go on. So some of these things are all getting tea. I already showed how pie up there, or tea, is with Lottie Ricks, and here it's getting confused with this tea. Okay. So now I'm going to deal with Carol's sham answers. And shooting towards the main riddle. Why is the raven like writing this? Okay. Here's how Carol talks about these sham answers. My dear Agnes, I sent you a riddle a few days ago with one of those sham answers. I mean an answer that's got the real answer inside it. And I think it is now time to send you the full answer. Well, this is just a precursor to another sham answer. And you never did, she never found the answer to that riddle. Here's what he says to another of his friends. My dear Gaynor, forgive me for having sent you a sham answer to begin with. So he's very aware of what he's doing, and he even explains that they're sham answers. Unfortunately, the sham answers are almost as difficult as the original puzzles. Now, here's the last edition of Alice came out in 1896. Carol died 2 years after this. Here's what he writes. He puts it as an author's note at the very beginning of that edition. He says, inquiries have been made so often addressed to me as to whether any answer to the Hatter's riddle can be imagined that I may as well put on record here what seems to me to be a fairly appropriate answer, viz. Because it can produce a few notes, though they're very flat, and it is never put with a wrong end in front. This, however, is merely an afterthought. The riddle was originally invented had no answer at all. I don't believe this for a second. But let's look at this. Here's his answer. Because it can produce a few notes, so they're very flat. And it is never put with a wrong end in front. Notice how you spell never? Raven, backwards, right? So that word is put with a wrong end in front. Okay? Now, I, like most of these, here's what the best answers so far that have been given. Because Poe wrote on both, Poe wrote the raven. Okay. Because it slopes with a flap, because there's a bee in both, because both have quills dipped in ink, because both have two eyes. So people are trying all sorts of different things, but most of them talk about both. And that's where I was looking, both, right? What's the similarity between both these things, and you give an answer that fits both. This is the only person that goes along with Carol. It. Okay? It can produce a few notes. And he's not talking about both, he's talking about it. And that it, I suppose, applies to both. Okay, so here he puts never, which spells raven. And I started thinking, it is never. So what if we flip the it around? And as you do that, you end up with T. And T is in the notation do re mi fa sol la T. And in the key of B, which is a major key, I'm told, I don't know anything about music, but that's supposed to be the flattest note, or providing the flattest notes. So I think that's what I mean. I think I'm on the right track. I think I'm getting somewhere. All right, let's see. And here, comes more botany. T, that's a real name. T, native name of several trees of the genus Cortulin, known also as cabbage tree. Here's what Darwin wrote this on his voyage natural voyage, I guess. La Lysias plant called tea. Okay. Carol, we know, read Darwin. I mean, even had he not written anything saying that he had read Darwin, he was so well known. He was a giant then. That it'd be difficult to see him not reading it. But anyway, he did read Darwin, and he went farther than that. He sent Darwin, in a letter, he sent him a photograph, volunteering to supply Darwin with photographs for a possible book on human emotions. So it seems that it's not too far of the ordinary to think that he might have come across T then, but in some ways he didn't have to. It was available in many books, this T as a cabbage tree. Now look, the cabbage tree, it's also special. They are to be found around the doors of the Sydney, Cabbage Tree Mob, pre-Wonderland. They are to be found around the doors of the Sydney Theatre as sort of loafers, known as the Cabbage Tree Mob. These are an unruly set of young fellows, native-born generally, dressed in a suit of fustian or colonial tweed and the emblems of their order, low crown cabbage palm hat. So it kind of fits along with the Hatter, making these comments about he's the one that puts forth the riddle. And Hatter, a bushworker who loves and works, who lives and works alone, a bush eccentric, also pre-Wonderland. And they work in mines. I remember when Alice is falling through the earth, she says, I wonder if I'll come up in New Zealand or Australia. Well, in this sense, she came up in Australia, I guess, for a bit. She's dealing with Australian things there. A Hatter, that's a bizarre person, like the Hatter in Wonderland is. And that's linked to these tea hats. Oh, here's the quotation. Here's what Alice says. As she's falling, I wonder if I shall fall right through the earth. How funny it'll be to come out among people that walk with their heads downwards. The antipathies, I think. She was rather glad there was no one listening this time, as it didn't sound at all the right word. But I shall have to ask them, what the name of the country is, you know? Please, ma'am, is this New Zealand or Australia? Okay, later. Carol speaks about how he chose Alice Adventures in Wonderland. At first, I first thought of Alice Adventures Underground, but that was like a lesson book in which instruction about mines would be administered in the form of a grill. Hatters, for the most part, worked in mines. They were known for, I should have made that clear. This, the Bendigo Diggings was one of the main gold mines in Australia. So hatters are associated with mines. Wonderland is associated with mines. Now, I've already spoken about the Doremi Fa Sol La Ti. Now, look what happens as we look at the murdering time. Time, Old Teutonic, Timon, apparently formed on a root T to stretch, extend, see tide. If you look at tide, you get something very similar. But the root is T, okay? And here it's been dissected right down the middle. Time. So I'm not sure if that's what he means by murdering time, but in some ways he's taking it apart anyway. Okay, so that's the answer to, or part of the answer. A lot of work needs to be done there. And this is Carol again playing with... Carol wrote this... book called A Tangled Tale, where he published a whole bunch of knots, he called them, which were mathematical problems, and people would write in and send in their answers, and he would grade them and he would put them in a class list. So here's one of the problems that he set out. Problem one, A and B began the year with only 1,000 pounds apiece. They borrowed not, they stole not. On the next New Year's Day, they had 60,000 pounds between them. How did they do it? Now, here's the solution that he gives. They went that day to the Bank of England. A stood in front of it, while B went round and stood behind it. Well, that's a heck of an answer. I mean, what does that mean? Okay. I believe that he's playing with it again. Okay. Now, what happens when you put... They went that day to the bank and stood... A stood in front of it. Eight. I think that's what's going on there. So now, the way to make sense of that is to see what he considered good answers. Nobody got that. But he says, two answers have been received, both worthy of much honor. Adelpate, that's the person that wrote in, I guess, makes them borrow zero and steal zero. So he using not as zero, right? And steal zero. And he says, both ciphers by putting them at the right-hand end of the 1,000 pounds, thus producing 100,000 pounds, which is well over the mark, but, or to express it in Latin, at spes infracta, has solved it even more ingeniously. With the first cipher, she turns the 1 of the 1,000 pounds into a 9, and that's the result of the original sum, thus getting 10,000 pounds. And by this, and in this, by means of the other 0, she turns the 1 into the 6, thus hitting the exact 60,000. So I think what he's getting at is... So I think this person is going like this. You got a 1, okay? And she's going to turn that into a 9. So she's going to put the 0 here, I guess. Right? I think that's what's going on here. And then later, you have a 1, and she's going to put the 0 there, making it into a 6. Oh, sorry. Going to make it into a 6. Now the problem, he's quite happy with this, right? Turning the 1,000 and multiplying by this to end up with 60,000. You end up with 60,000. The problem is that there are two people, A and B. So it doesn't add up in the sense of either you end up with 61,000 or you end up with 120,000. Or, I'm not sure. But with the 8, and if you follow this, then it's not a problem. Because you end up with 80,000, or 8,000 first. You multiply by 8, right? So you have the 1,000. Now you're going to turn this into an 8, and you're going to subtract the 2 that they have. You end up with 6,000. Then you put the... remember, you put by means of the other series, one stood in front of it while B went round. Okay, so B goes round and stood behind it. So I think that's the way to make sense of that. Anyway, that's as far as my mathematics goes. Now, I think I'm not sure people are. The Hunting of the Snark. Have people read The Hunting of the Snark? Anybody? Maybe? No. Okay. Then maybe I'm going to leave it there and we can just have questions. Because I have a little more on The Hunting of the Snark, but if we haven't, you know. It's okay. It's a fairly unknown work, so I'll leave it there.
But this is only a small fragment of the huge periodic potential of Lewis Carroll life. You know, Lewis Carroll is the same as the mathematician Charles Dodson. And there is an isomorphism between Alice in Wonderland, through the Looking Glass, the writer Lewis Carroll and the mathematical teacher Charles Dodson, his books about logical exercise, because you can, this is an excellent semiotic exercise to find correspondence between paradoxes in Alice in Wonderland and the logical paradoxes in Charles Dodson's writing. And this happens, you know, these paradoxes usually are in most cases self-referential situations where the three corners of the signs are superposed. And it was another English writer before him calling attention of this thing in the 18th century. It was Laurent Fern with Tristram Shandy. And all these things happened much long before mathematicians began to pay attention to this phenomena. You remember our colleague from Japan, when she spoke, she put the keyword self-reference. So the keyword in Lewis Carroll, self-reference. And in our self-reference, but they anticipated this one century almost.
Yes, but the self is much more complex, right? The self is botanical, mathematical, logical, and so when Carroll points to himself, in some ways he's pointing to a whole universe. And he's very concerned with identity. And notice, he picked, there's definitely a connection in many ways, even between the names, Charles Lutwidge Dodgson and Lewis Carroll. Charles Carroll, he just changed it over to Latin. Lutwidge, Ludovico, Lewis, right? So everything about the man is interesting and paradoxical, but at the same time, his conception of paradox is very different. It would seem paradoxical that Alice would walk on forever and not get anywhere. And yet she does. He shows us an example. But it's so hidden as well that people aren't reading the book, I guess, with the care that it requires. I mean, children have access to many parts of the book, but so do scholars. And I think it's meant for scholars, just that children can enjoy it too. It's wonderful. And, well, children get a different part of it too, and they're much more creative in their reading, which helps. And I think they were much more creative back then than they are now. Things are getting dumbed down, I believe, or at least a creative part of us, how to read text in a very involved yet creative manner. And this is a very good example of that. Yes?
I had never thought of the possibility that Alice could be moving in circles. I'd be interested in whether it was clockwise or counterclockwise, but for a quite other reason. But that could also explain, without drugs, her confused state, because children like to make themselves in a trance by going around in circles.
Yes, and notice what she says. She says, stop doing that to the cat, even though it's not the cat's problem. I think it's going out of her field of vision. She says, you're making me giddy. And Carroll uses the word giddy in other places to mean, I'm getting, dizzy. Yes, exactly.
I do think that last flower you showed us, though, is not foxglove. All the others were, but the very last image didn't read like a foxglove.
Yeah, I'll have to check. I mean, the he's playing around with mixing different plants. I mean, and arums and foxgloves. In a different section, he does tell us this is a foxglove, right? So he identifies it for us. Now, arums and foxgloves don't grow together, yet he's using them. So I don't know. There could be another riddle within this other plant that looks like a foxglove. He seems to have loved tea. He continually comes to it, and it's always tea time. Even at the knot where the last section of tea that came, yeah, when he was a much older man. So he always comes back. He's got his vocabulary that he uses. Of course, he changes it a little bit and so on. And I think he lived a fairly interesting life in this sense. He's setting out puzzles and these sham answers and so on, and in some way they're not getting solutions. So he's continually giving more sham answers, and so in some ways he wants people to engage with these riddles, but on the other hand, I don't think he wants them to find the answers either. He seems very torn. He continually gives stuff and then he seems to take it back. So at the end of And some of the messages in Alice are fairly profound, and in some ways they went against the grain. I don't know if he wanted to answer for them during his lifetime. So there's always with him, you're always treading on fairly slippery surfaces or thin ice sometimes. But he does have a vocabulary, he always uses it, so a concordance is very useful, because then you can find where he's using it. I mean, a concordance isn't going to help you very much there, because it's not the same word. He changes it, right? T, 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 and the letter T. But if you keep an ear on the sound and an eye on the look of the word, it really helps, because then you can start making some of these connections. Yes.
Do you happen to know when the Tungus word shaman came into English? Because when you say shaman, sham answers. I, as an anthropologist, am hearing shaman here.
Right. Well, I can tell you right now. I brought my etymological dictionary. I can check that out for you. Okay. Yeah. There won't be a workshop, I guess, right? So, but I can let you know after this, and I can look that up. But yeah, here's an expansion of our language, and I guess an expansion of mathematics. I mean, I don't know enough about it, but it seems that when you start introducing words into mathematics and start playing with them, it adds a whole new set of, in a way, counters or pieces into this big chess game that he's playing. And he continually, you know, well, in some ways checkmates all of us. And any more questions? Yes.
Neighbor who was 3 years ahead of me. And I was given this book, Alice in Wonderland. I can't tell you what, you know, there was more than one. I have no idea. I haven't seen it since a very long time. So I'm not sure exactly what it was. There was something about Alice and about the rabbit.
Right, yeah, this is the book.
About the mirrors.
That's the two. Alice in Wonderland, you see, means that you're going to get Alice Adventures in Wonderland and Through the Looking Glass as one text. Even though they're very, I mean, in some ways they're similar books, they're very different stories too. But this is what Alice in Wonderland has come to mean.
I really wanted to understand what was going on there. I didn't think it was going on much. And probably back then I was less inclined to be, I was less of a suspicious type to try to read anything behind. And I don't think I've been going about making any attempts to read the text otherwise than it was written. Now, the two questions were as follows. What was Lewis Carroll's intended audience?
Do you want me to answer that now, or do you want to?
Probably even more importantly, how would one approach or dare translate such texts, because I was given a book translated into Romanian.
Right.
So I'm looking at these notes and neighbor and just one attempt or dare to translate.
For the first question, I know of at least one person that these books were meant for, and that was his best friend, George MacDonald. MacDonald is the one that first wrote the book called Fantasties. Carol read that and inspired Alice. And they go back and forth, and MacDonald wrote the Curdy books, answering, and they go back. So they seem to be writing just for each other. At the same time, I think he also writes for, well, anybody. I mean, anybody can access these books, at least in the English language. It's more difficult than other languages. And I'm going to touch on that right now, I guess. When I first started doing my studies, I thought, translators, they're going to be the ones that are going to be finding things, because they're going to find these strange words, they're going to go to dictionaries, and then they're going to find these other meanings. But I get the feeling that translation doesn't work like that. I think translators are as lazy as anybody else. They see a word, and they kind of go, oh, this kind of, in my mind, sounds like this other word, and they put that in. So the in-depth study that's required to translate, I have a feeling that once you know some of what's going on here, it would make translation easier. Because it's not nonsense. Yes?
The famous extreme case is Jabberwocky, which does come from the Alice book.
Yes.
T'was brillig, and the flabby toes, the gyre and yellow in the wave. All mincy where the bar goes, and the moon rats out grave. How can you translate it? Almost every word is a neologism, or most likely a portmanteau word.
Exactly. That's the key.
At the same time, it has been very well translated into German. Es brillig war. Perfectly German beginning. Better than English. And I'm told that it's been translated into good Japanese. This is a question of the meaning of translation. And I think that a good translation of Jabberwocky has to be full of portmanteau words and so forth in the target language. Then will not be the same portmanteau words.
See, as weird as Jabberwocky sounds, right, to a Sprillig and the Slidey Toes, Carroll gives us the methodology he used, and that's the portmanteau. So as soon as we start splitting those words, brill and lig, well, start with Jabberwocky. Jabber means talking, and usually it was back then talking in some kind of language that's very hard to understand. Sometimes it was like people would say, don't jabber at me in French, right? So what's involved here is a language that's difficult to understand, and walk is related to struggles in a dialectal dictionary that I found. So in the very title of Jabberwocky is the answer to Jabberwocky. Once we start splitting off these words, chopping them up, like a portmanteau, the way that he pictures it, it's one of these valises where you pack half and then half, and then they fold and create one, you know, a piece of luggage. So he's packing meaning into these words. And like I say, Jabberwocky, the very name tells us quite a bit about how to understand this. It's a very difficult poem to come to terms with. There's still some words that I haven't found, which keep me from publishing but it's coming. I mean, once you have the method, it's just a matter of doing all the legwork. No, and I think that's only half the story, the triumphing over people that don't get the answer to the riddle, and some don't even get the riddle itself, never mind the answer. But on the other hand, there's a movement to, in some ways, bring up the level of his readers, to get them to start reading more carefully and growing through the book. Like, maybe there's one picture that really sets this whole thing... And it's this. this is central to Wonderland. Here you have Alice. This is taken from the idea. It's taken from Blake, who wrote a book called For Children, The Gates of Paradise. And the three stages of a person's growth are the worm or here caterpillar, a chrysalis, and a butterfly. Okay? And I think you're supposed to make your way through the worm stage where, you know, you're just eating, defecating, dying, and then you're in the chrysalis here. Her name is Alice. So she's the Chris Alice that's dreaming the adventures through the book. And at the end, she will wake up as a butterfly that can get a much better view of everything at the end of the book. So in some ways, it's a textbook also to teach us how to become more creative in our reading. So on the one hand, you have them triumphing over people, which is a very negative thing and very mean. I mean, what does Lottie Ricks make of, turn around, where's your hair? I don't know. It seems pretty odd. And she probably, it doesn't sound like a positive thing. And on the other hand, you have him doing this, showing us in some ways the three stages that we can progress through our lives in order to become wiser. So like, once again, you have, in a way, a paradox. And so much with Carol is about paradox, two different aspects. I mean, some people think that he has split personality. I don't believe it. But he definitely had conflicts. And, what can I say? He was a conflicted man, and yet he lived a fairly productive, happy life. So, yeah.
I've always been amazed by the amount of sufferings that it takes to impose on Ellis through the stories that are grouped together. She suffers a lot. She suffers from the nonsense opposed to her, from the bad behavior, or something like that, etc. She suffers intensely, which is why modern kids might not like that literature very much, as much as the adults do. The thing that's going on is, of course, that content here is produced by the signifiers instead of the Soviet. The signified meaning is produced by operations on the signifier instead of being produced by operations of the underlying thinking mind, which is in the referential area. And I mean, so the signifier changes its status from being a reflection of the signified meaning to being the cause of the meaning. That makes, of course, the meaning suffer, and Alice suffers from the effect of this sort of symbiosis, of course. I think that has a lot to do with what Salomon says here about self-reference. What is self-reference? Well, it's the signifier, the reference to the signifier.
But notice that she gets better. I mean, she gets better until at the end of the story, it's she that calls an end to this, right? She says, you're nothing but a pack of cards, and ends that dream. So she gets more powerful, and she can start to deal with that weird logic there. And she starts, in some ways, like when she goes around her own axes like that, she's proven the cat wrong. The cat had just told her, here's a rule, and you cannot break this rule. If you walk for long enough, and yet she's proving him wrong right on the spot. So
The context is, of course, that there was a general consciousness in the cultural environment, including the linguistic and the literary environment. I'm thinking of authors like Remo Roussel in France, who produced his stories out of the secondary and connotative meanings of the lexemes that he used from and wrote from verse to verse through entire verse novels by producing synonyms of secondary meanings out of the dictionary. That's another way to talk about content, of course. I'm also thinking of what happened in linguistics when Saussure started working on verse, Latin verse, and culture, we have seen an explosion of techniques for producing artificial content out of manipulations of simple files. So, such as in the French formalist group organized around Raymond Queneau, not to say this time, but Queneau, and his workshop of formal literature, musical bourgeois de littérature potentielle, from the 40s and up to today, is still alive, and they're doing exactly this, by trying to produce meaning in the art with rules imposed on the signifier. Of course, the members of the Nico are writers and mathematicians. One of the foremost examples here would be Jacques Rougeau in France.
I'm sorry, I'm going to have to cut you. I've got another question. Maybe we can continue that later on.
Just on translation, of course, when you translate an S plus 7 by Queneau, where you take a text and you take out all the substantives, all the nouns, and go 7 steps down the dictionary, and then you rewrite by keeping all the morphology of the text, of course, you produce artificial nonsense, which is a great source of literary delight, of course. But when you translate that, either you translate the results, which we have seen in the previous...
I'm sorry. I'm going to have to... we're going to run out of time. He's got yes.
Or you translate by following the rules and you produce another list of statements in the target, then it's unclear what...
Yes. And 40
to be current in the local description as the man in the public. So, this is what the Oxford movement was going on. The Oxford movement was a time in which it was felt that the university system was not paying attention to religious values properly, and that the hair splitting logical aspect of which it got into was somehow against the university.
Yes, and I mean we have to look into that, right? He's anti something, perhaps. I'm not sure. He could be playing on that. Russell and the other two you mentioned, I mean, that's anachronistic in a way, right? They came after all of this. But I mean, the point's still being made. And what was Carroll? Is there a political message behind this? Perhaps, I don't know. I don't think anybody's made a good case for it. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. Yes.
All humorous comics have agreements. And humor is a way of dealing with their grievances. So, what was his grievance? And while I have the floor, I just want to mention, if you're interested in an interesting translation of Alice in Wonderland, there's an iPhone app run by Chris Stevens, which is just delightful.
I'm not sure if it could. I see it more in terms of a. It's almost an addiction to language, and when people talk about him getting high, and he does put a mushroom, so they think, oh well, was he getting high? Well, at the time, everybody was getting high. I mean, you have a headache, and you take. No, they had much. Yeah, at the time, the Advil was, what was the stuff called?
Laudanum.
Yes, laudanum, and which is, a total narcotic, right? So everybody was getting high at that level. On the other level, he was just getting high on language. Imagine playing these games and the whole world changes where no one thing is just that one thing. It's a whole bunch of other things too. And now he's got the mind to link all of these things that seem very disparate. And so I see it more in terms of a game. Wittgenstein later picks up on the language game of it. And he does, I mean, in some ways, there's another paradox. He never grew up. Another, boy, did he ever grow up. So there again with Carol, you have this, he's both the worm and the sleeping, and the butterfly, right? He's looking over top of the whole thing, and in some ways he's triumphing over everybody. On the other hand, he's right with us as well. He's writing for us. Is he the returned man that went into the Plato's cave? Maybe. I don't know. That's it? Okay. Thank you.
But I thought that what he meant is to gave as his own to the lot number six.
Right.
I thought he meant that if A is in front of the Bank of England and B stands behind it,
yeah,
then the Bank of England is in between. And so they have all the contents of the Bank of England
between them. Yeah.
Now, he gave that as his own answer.
Yeah.
But I agree that there's a sham answer contained in what he quoted, because it was never turned around. Turned backward, and then he spells never so that it is reversed. Raven.
Exactly.
That's another game with the reader. But I don't think he intended this as a sham answer. I think he intended it as the answer, because he had the problem open for a year and a half.
For months anyway.
Yeah.
This is another answer. The thing is, this gets you to 60,000 exactly. One of the one of the complaints against 100,000 is that it didn't quite.
Exactly.
And with him, he's very picky, right?
Yeah.